Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tipping is a familiar and long-held tradition in the U.S., but many consumers are confused by a growing list of appeals, from vehicle repair to takeout food. Tech payment companies, including Square and Toast, have devised technology for tip options for every conceivable service, and that's helped bolster service workers and others, but consumers are unsure about the amounts and the whens and whys to tip. And the Federal Trade Commission plans to weigh in on so-called junk fees. Brian X. Chen is the lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times, where he writes the Tech Fix column. He wrote about tech and tipping in a recent column titled, "Tech is Allowing Businesses to Overcharge You in Tips." Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hey, thanks, Ann.
All right, so is this the whole tipping thing literally what so-called junk fees are, or do junk fees include this proliferation of tipping options?
Broadly speaking, junk fees are when services and businesses tack on extra fees that don't add any value. I think the most obvious example right now are convenience fees, like, you know, Ticketmaster, just adding to the cost of a ticket. The FTC has said they're going to crack down on junk fees, and some people are speculating that services that include tips for when they don't ordinarily rely on tips could be included in that category.
Who decides what that is? Is it arbitrary, or is there something sort of etched in stone about what's real tradition and what's not?
I think it's really up to the businesses to decide, but I think as a consumer, it's pretty obvious when a business is just asking for tips and it's like the owner of the business and they don't ordinarily get those. But, you know, for example, obviously when service workers make $1 an hour, they rely on tips, and those are the people who should probably be getting tips. When it comes to businesses that don't ordinarily get tips, I think that's where consumers start to get confused. You know, I gave the example of my motorcycle mechanic who installed tires for me. You know, I paid for the tires myself. I brought them in. I paid him for his labor and the use of his machine to install the tires, and then he asked for a tip. So it's like kind of adding extra cost for basically no reason.
Is it clear that the folks, like the guy that repaired your bike, are expecting tips, or are they just part of a software program that their employers tacked on?
Well, at least in the case of the motorcycle mechanic, he was the owner of the business, and he chose to turn on that tipping screen.
Okay.
So it is an option. Like, anybody using this technology can just flip a switch and turn on the gratuity screen. And because it's so simple and effortless, a lot of people who don't typically do that are doing that.
In 2013, Square released a point-of-sale product that replaced cash registers and allowed vendors to use the tablets instead. We've gotten awful used to that in the last 10 years. How did this kickstart the tipping technology to the next level?
Yeah, so about 10 years ago, Square introduced the Square Stand. It was just this white stand that had the credit card reader, held an iPad. I was actually there in San Francisco when the CEO introduced it in a cafe. And so it made it very easy for the cashier to input the order into the iPad screen, flip around the screen for you to swipe your credit card, and then show the tipping screen. And fast forward to today, and you see this everywhere, right? I mean, you see this in takeout places, you see this even in grocery stores, in my experience, and it makes it, you know, like there's been a lot of copycats too from Toast and other companies. So it really did spawn that point of sales service technology where, you know, it was very easy for people to ask for tips.
I don't think I've ever seen it at a grocery store. Who would even get the tips?
Yeah, so that's something I also wrote about in my column. So, you know, my own experiences inspired this. And also I was reading about other people's experiences on Reddit and looking at them on TikTok. I had a grocery store where I was just buying some takeout sushi, you know, it was like pre-made sushi from the grocery store. And then they flipped the iPad screen around and showed me the tipping buttons between 10-30%. You know, granted, it was a small grocery store. It's not like a big supermarket chain. It's not like Safeway, you know, but it was an independent grocer that just decided to start showing the tipping screen. And I hit the no tip button and the cashier seemed really disappointed. And I can understand, like, maybe it's confusing because they do sell some freshly made food. It's totally optional for you to buy it, but I didn't, you know, and maybe they expect tips from those people who are getting takeout, but they're just showing the screen to everybody basically. So I think that's kind of where it starts to get confusing.
I guess I wonder, I'm thinking about this, the you said sushi, I think, or something. I'm just thinking about if I knew it was going to the guy who made the sushi, I would tip him if I were sitting at a sushi bar, right?
Yeah, and then and that's the thing. It's like all these etiquettes get extra confusing, especially during the pandemic. You know, a lot of people who don't typically ask for tips started asking for them, and a lot of us who were, you know, more privileged and able to support those businesses were happy to, you know, give more cash. But you know, the issue being that now, you know, Biden has declared that the emergency state of the pandemic is over. A lot of people are not wearing masks anymore. Business has largely returned to normal. And yet, a lot of these businesses are still asking for tips. And in fact, even more of them than before. Like I was reading on Reddit, like people were talking about candy stores asking for tips. And it's like, what are you tipping for in a candy store when you're buying candy, you know?
Yeah, I can see how, yeah, the tipping got it grew during the pandemic, and how do you contract that habit now? You feel almost guilty.
And the thing is that it's really fascinating because designers know exactly what they're doing to influence your behavior in this context. It's the fundamental power of opting out, forcing people to opt out versus opting in. When you think about the tipping jar in the past, you know, the real physical tipping jar, that's basically an opt-in experience where, you know, you can throw some cash in the jar and you can complete the transaction without even throwing money in the jar if you want. So you're opting into that. That's very easy for you to skip if you want to. When it comes to these screens that show the tipping options, the buttons, that's basically like you have to opt out of that in order to even complete the transaction. That is, if you don't want to tip, right? So they're taking advantage of this behavior where they know that people are way less likely to opt out than they are to opt into things. And that has increased tips, which is a great thing for service workers who rely on gratuity. But again, it's in the hands of everyone. So in some contexts, it can start to feel perhaps manipulative. One example I'll give is I got a letter from a reader who said that her dog boarding facility was showing the tipping screen when she's getting back her dog. And that seemed unusual to me because, you know, you're paying for their labor for taking care of your dog. And that can feel kind of manipulative because you don't want them to harm your dog next time you bring the dog, right? So you're going to tip them just in case that happens, right? And I think those situations are where people are starting to get really frustrated and feel this is out of control.
And again, I go back to the, I don't know if the people who actually did the dirty work of taking care of my dog are getting the money when
Yeah,
it, you
or
know.
is it the owner of the business instead
Right.
who is just, you know, running the accounting? Who really knows? You know, it's all kind of a black box. And there have been horror stories where people found out that their tips were stolen by the business owner. And I can't prove that that's always what happens, but it is something that has happened.
Well, it makes it easier to be able to do it this digitally in this way. You're kind of removed from having to worry about it. Whereas, if I get my dog groomed, I certainly tip the groomer.
Sure.
I think I get down on my hands and knees and thank her sometimes.
And
But
that's similar to a hairstylist that you
yeah,
also tip, right? So,
exactly,
yeah.
exactly. The concept that encourages users to tip has been used before, for example, to encourage people to vote. What's the connection there?
Right. So, many years ago, California was asking how we could get more people to register to vote. And, you know, this has been an issue because there's inequality or there's difficulty for people to act to vote because a lot of people weren't registering. So designers were brought in and they realized exactly what I was saying earlier, that we could just have people opt into it by default. So when you're filling out your driver's license application or a change in address application, it's going to pre-select the box that, you know, you're registering to vote as you fill out that application. And they knew that, you know, people were much less likely to opt out than they were to opt into registering to vote. So definitely, there's a sharp uptick in registrations for voting, which is definitely a good thing. So again, you know, designers are aware of this behavior and they have used it for good in some circumstances. And you know, I'm not saying that with tipping it's bad. I'm just saying it's definitely good for the service workers, but it depends on who's using it. And some people might be using it for dishonest reasons.
Okay, and I wanted to go back to the FTC announcing a crackdown on so-called junk fees, and you mentioned that it's tack-ons that have been, you know, widely criticized, say, with Ticketmaster and that kind of a thing, but we don't think about it at the Starbucks. So, you know, who's going to decide, and what would a crackdown look like when they decide what tipping falls into that category or not?
So the FTC did not comment on the story when I reached out. I did talk to a consultant, a person who, you know, is a lawyer. I mean, sorry, he's a designer that lawyers talk to about so-called dark designs. And a dark design is when a designer uses manipulation to force you to do something. Like, you know, for example, if the tipping button was so big and then the no tip button was like invisible or so small, then that's an example of deceptive design. So not all the companies are the same. Like, so Square is not an example of deceptive design because all their buttons are the same size. But there are other companies who have copied the technology that do highlight the tipping button by default and make it very difficult for you to opt out. I think those examples are probably going to be targets of any sort of, you know, crackdown by the FTC if they're aware of it, you know. But again, they didn't want to talk for the story. It's going to be up to, I think, you know, consumers, if they run into these issues, they can complain to the FTC. That's probably their best bet in terms of any protection from practices that seem abusive. But otherwise, you know, the encouragement or the recommendations I gave to people on an individual basis is that for now, like if you can just pay in cash, that will avoid showing the tipping screen and, you know, you won't feel controlled by it. And of course, you should tip when you should tip. But if you really feel like you shouldn't, just hit the no tip button. And if the merchant gives you a hard time, then you might want to consider going to a different business.
A user experience consultant in Britain you interviewed said he doesn't consider gratuity screens deceptive. What's his argument there?
That's the person I talked to who actually acts as a consultant for the lawyers who pursue deceptive designs. So his argument with Square, you know, for example, is that the buttons are all relatively the same size. They're not invisible. But there are smaller startups that have copied Square and they're offering point of sale services. Their names escape me right now, but some of them do things like highlight the tipping button by default and make the no tip button very, very small. Those are more egregious examples of so-called dark design.
Well, if nothing else, this makes me want to make sure I double check and look see if there's a no tipping button, because usually all I see is 10%, 15%, 20%, 25%.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, again, you don't have to tip when you feel like it's not right. And I encourage everybody to just be mindful, you know, just like with any technology. I mean, it's easier said than done, you know, like as a columnist who writes about technology every week, I encourage people to take a pause, look at the settings in their apps to make sure they're sharing the amount of data they actually want to share. I would say the same exercise would be applicable to when you're checking out at a cashier. You know, take your time, take a pause and ask yourself, is this something I actually want to do? Like, is this a situation where I would typically tip? And do I really think it's going to this person? And if I do want to tip, maybe I should tip in cash. You know, I definitely know it's going to the person in that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just slowing down and being mindful, I think, is a healthy exercise.
Well, Brian Chen, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ann.
Brian X. Chen is the lead consumer technology writer for the New York Times. He writes the Tech Fix column. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The publishing industry's premier children's book fair just wrapped up in Bologna, Italy, with 80 selections from 30 countries. Top titles included digital books and multimedia offerings, although not as many as in pre-pandemic years, along with traditional reads. New in this year, a digital libraries category. Warren Buckleitner, an educational researcher, product reviewer, and editor of Children's Technology Review, served as an international judge at the book fair. Welcome back, Warren.
It's great to be with you, Anne.
Did you get to go to Italy?
Yes, I was in Italy, and it was really cool.
Awesome. What makes this the premier publishing event for children's books?
Well, it's 60 years old, and it has just become a tradition. It's right in the center of Italy, so it's kind of a cool context in a medieval kind of place. And it brings people from all over the world to trade rights. There's authors, illustrators, this year were their comic books. And about 25 years ago, they invited me to come over to help them create an award and a mini conference on technology. So I've been going to Italy for over 25 years. So please feel sorry for me.
Okay, well, I'll just get some recommendations for Airbnbs someday from you. But So this isn't new that they're paying attention to technology, but there is a new this year, a digital libraries category. What is that?
Well, the way to think about a children's book is that it's a bundle of, it's a script, right? It can become a video. It can become, if you think of a famous title like Harry Potter, it started as a book, but became, everything, theme rides and movies and video games. And so a lot of rights are generated from any sort of work like that. And the Bologna Book Fair has become the place to go. It's where J.K. Rowling went to sell her rights to Scholastic. That's where those deals are made. So it's a lot of business goes on there as well as other stuff.
There were fewer interactive entries this year compared to pre-pandemic years. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think the TV ate my iPad. It's people aren't making as many apps. The market just isn't there as much. Now, the rich get richer in the app space. The famous titles like Marvel and, the big licensed characters are finding their way in apps. But there used to be over 200 entries, and this year there were less than 10 in terms of pure apps.
Well, wow. I mean, why not as many apps? What's the big? You're saying that people got more attached to their TV than their laptop or their tablet.
Yeah, and also turning their tablet into the TV. So, like if you can get Disney Plus or Netflix or YouTube on your iPad now, kids aren't stupid. They'll go there and watch, good stuff on, like Bluey, for example, is a title I'm really excited about. But we think about it, the term, the hot word over there in Italy is cross media. So that's the, remember multimedia? Mm-hmm. There, all these words get invented. So now it's cross media. So it's like from book to movie. So we did review a lot of films, and there were libraries. So we had about 20 entries for different libraries, and the two that won, one of them is making books available to refugee children for free, so that if a child has Wi-Fi and a tablet, they can access a huge library of literature. And that's important for Syria and Ukraine and in Russia right now. One of the cool things about the book fair, Anne, is it's very international. And so this year, the war in Ukraine was very much on everybody's minds, as was the things going on with China. And it's really kind of amazing in that way.
Tell us about two of the winners, Atelier Fun Fun, which allows children to create their own stories, and Home.
Yeah, so Home is, okay, can you pronounce any of the titles? I can't speak French or Italian.
Atelier Fun Fun, which allows, yeah, Atelier.
And that's pretty good.
And
yeah.
Home, it's got a question mark in it.
Yeah, so Home is actually my translation of the word home.
Okay.
That's the title that won. So if you can look at that, it's the first review on our website. And also if you go to Bologna Book Fair cross media entries, you can find a video and look at the video. It's absolutely gorgeous. And guess what technology they used? Paper and ink. So, okay.
Weird.
That works.
Okay. It's technology. Yeah.
It's technology, but it's the title is about a child finding home wherever they end up. And so for a refugee child, for example, or somebody that's been displaced, that title is so beautiful. It's so moving. And it's a reminder that at the end of the day, we are all looking for quality, you know, the best illustrations and the best sounds. And that title delivered the goods. We were just like looking at our screens going, oh my God, that's gorgeous. So it's called Home. And, you know, I think it's important to look at, you know, all the entries of these contests. It's a smart way to kind of keep up with the technology and what the state of the art is.
Mental illness was a topic of The Tree of Ecstasy and Unbearable Sadness. How was that subject handled? So important these days.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, this artist who was suffering from severe depression just went in and started creating. And when we looked at the title, it was like so heavy. I mean, I almost can't describe in public the visualizations.
Huh.
And so we had quite a debate about it. And what we realized is it doesn't water down what depression is. And we love the authenticity of this title. And then at the end, it comes out the ecstasy. And it's sort of a illustrated story of in video form. So it's both in book and video of a journey of struggling with depression and mental illness and sort of coming out of it. And that there's no words to it, no language. So it crosses borders quite well.
There were stories that talked about gender equality and the fight over gender stereotypes. I guess Gallimard's Les Culottes or Les Culottes, I don't know.
Oh my God, Anne, you did it. I can't. So you can speak French too. Good for you.
I can make it up, but.
You know what La Culottes means?
Well, I know what culottes are. They're pants.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Skirt. Okay. It's a pants skirt.
All right, great. So yeah, that title, you nailed it. It's a humorous look at famous female figures in these pants and sort of these tight pants. And it's very irreverent, and it's a, you know, it shows, it sort of breaks different gender stereotypes that that we loved. So yeah, that was cool. That was really cool to find. There's so many great titles to look at.
It's so amazing how creative people are. There's an animated TV series, El Diafo. It rethinks disability with humor. This is for children again, right?
Yeah, now that one is like, we loved it because we just call it El Defo. So like deaf. It's about a little girl who goes to school with a giant hearing aid, and she actually has to wear it. This is in the 70s, right, when hearing aids were just these big chunks of computers that you had to wear. And her overcoming her insecurity and turning that giant hearing aid into a superpower. And so that became, I think Scholastic published it. Mm-hmm. And no, it's on Apple TV.
Okay.
Apple Plus. they took the book. It was a comic book, and they took the book and turned it into this beautiful animated series. And so for any kid who, you know, any normal kid always is very insecure about whether wearing glasses or, you know, when you go to school for the first time, it nails that. It really addresses those feelings of insecurity. So I really love that title.
You know, going back to The Tree of Ecstasy and The Unbearable Sadness, it was one of several entries dealing with emotional wellness, right? This was something that people are really plugging into now.
Well, we've come through a really tough period. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic, you know, when you take tens of thousands of creative people, illustrators and authors, they deal with things by writing about it. And so there was a lot, there were several like heavy titles that a book is a reflection of culture, and our collective cultures just went through quite a period. So we definitely saw some of the pandemic related themes in this year's entries.
Something that we're always going through, it seems like, is an era of book banning. It's sort of endemic now. The move by far-right conservative groups to ban books in school libraries throughout the country makes me wonder if any of these books dealing with, you know, these, you know, controversial quote-unquote topics will reach children here.
All I can say is there was a session about, it's really weird hearing far-right U.S. politicians being talked about over in Italy, and just try to silence these voices. I mean, when I was over there, I was so aware of the life, you know, it, and it's post-pandemic. The fair has really bounced back, and there's no doubt that no one was wearing masks. It's almost like masks were, you know, just we're so done with that. The mask has become something bigger. And so I'm very confident that there's no way that these voices will ever be silenced.
You note that, quote, making goodness attractive, end quote, still matters to win one of these competitions. What are the elements that bring a good story, art, music, or design to young minds? I mean, it's one thing when we're talking about adults, we got to remind ourselves, we're talking about literature and art for children here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I always walk away from being a judge for this contest is that beautiful images and beautiful sounds and a strong story never go out of style. And another thing that if you're ever interested, let's say you're going into retirement, just saying, and you want to write a book, right? That you've got more tools and more pipelines than ever before. You know, you can make a video on YouTube. You can, there's more ways you can reach the world with your ideas, with your music, with your narrative. And those narratives count. They're important. And so it's kind of a nice thing to see so many ideas. It's kind of like going to this big buffet of life and all these people who are trying their best to bring, you know, they put their best pictures, their best stories out there. So, and of course, making goodness attractive comes from Fred Rogers, and that's what we all try to do. We want to give our kids the best stuff that we can.
What is your sense about how interactive entries will or won't bounce back in coming years?
Well, the thing to remember, Anne, is that over the years we've talked a lot about good apps, and those still are running in the app store. It's just a matter of finding them. And so they'll never go out of style. And I'll always argue that a multi-touch screen with a really high quality experience will, a child will find their way to that experience. Nintendo is not hurting in sales right now, right? Because they still understand how to harness the power of interactive. So interactive media, a well-designed interactive experience is really a better mousetrap for helping a child learn to read or learn to express themselves. So it's not going away. The titles are still there. I think the issue is more like any new technology, it's sort of settling itself out. And in another 10 years, it'll all we'll kind of know where it fits.
I'm curious. I'm not sure we've ever talked about virtual reality before necessarily, and how that's going to, it's growing. It's growing more accessible. It's growing more affordable. What are your thoughts about that in children?
Well, I mean, I'm very excited about it because you can put on a Oculus, you know, which has now become affordable for about $300 to $500. And, you know, it kind of works now. And you can put a child's head into anything, right? I mean, there's this interactive tour of the White House. It's free. It's on YouTube. And you can sit next to Barack Obama and he's like sitting right there and you can see how big his hands are and like, oh my gosh, it blows your mind. So, you know, I'm a teacher, former teacher, and whenever you can blow a kid's mind, that's what, in a good way, those tools let you do that. And so I think that I'll always be on a life quest to find the best quality stuff, whether it's through a headset or whether it's through a phone where you hold your camera up and something pops up, or a map that comes to life, or Pokemon Go, or, you know, there's so many ways that you can help a child learn more, experience more, expand their world, or acquire a skill like playing the piano or something that's very, or learning Italian, something that's really hard, which I'll never learn, but gotta keep trying.
Well, Warren Buckleitner, thanks so much for your time as always. I really appreciate it.
Cheers to you, Ann. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Wonderful talking with you, too. Warren Buckleitner is editor of the Children's Technology Review. He's an educational researcher, product reviewer, and editor, and served as an international judge at the book fair in Bologna, Italy, with 80 selections from 30 countries. Pretty cool. We'll put a link to the Children's Technology Review on our website at wosu.org/allsides. So check that out. We have a little bit more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Federal Communications Commission has unveiled its largest ever push to make broadband more affordable. And it's an effort that will make $66 million worth of grants available to help bridge the digital divide, especially in historically underserved or unserved communities. Russell Holley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, is here to tell us more. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what does this program do?
Yeah, so it's called the Affordable Connectivity Program, and its general goal is to offer discounts on internet connection in areas where it's just really expensive to get connected. There are a lot of places where broadband isn't widely available, and maybe satellite's the only option, but that satellite can be pretty expensive to maintain on a monthly basis. There are a lot of rural neighborhoods where, you know, the closest thing with a steady internet connection is the local Walmart, because libraries have closed in those areas as well. There's actually about an hour and a half from me, a gas station that has a table set up where kids can come and you know, use the internet for school, because the internet in that area is just really expensive. There's only a handful of people, you know, comparatively, so it's hard to justify, laying those lines. So the Affordable Connectivity Program has, kind of two different parts. One is to help subsidize the cost of the actual internet connection, and the other is a set of discounts on actual computers to get connected to the internet in the first place.
It doesn't sound like a lot of money to me. You know, the problem goes across the country, and a lot of it's a function of geography. And when you say, oh, I'll buy a computer, well, that means that 4 or 5 years down the road, you got to buy another computer probably. It doesn't seem sustainable.
It's definitely not. You know, the goal here is really more about boosting awareness with the grants that are out right now. These are more about, you know, kind of communicating to these neighborhoods that these options are available, and not necessarily about a financial cap on you know, kind of what subsidies can be made. One of the interesting hardware subsidies is a one-time discount of up to $100 as long as that person contributes anywhere from $10 to $50 towards the purchase of a laptop. If you go into, you know, BestBuy.com and you look up the cost of a laptop, $150 laptop is just not going to last you a super long time. So the point that you make there is pretty sound. You know, the best you're going to end up getting in that situation is a Chromebook that's probably not even as functional as the one that is available to a lot of these kids in schools. So it really is fairly limiting.
And it, you know, we called it the FCC's largest ever push to make broadband more affordable, which suggests to me that they've really never done much at all about this.
That's right. A lot of what's been done in the past has been encouraging, you know, cooperation and often competition in places where it's appropriate to do so. But we're now, you know, reaching another set of hurdles where there are just communities that don't have the necessary infrastructure, and building it doesn't really, you know, help any of the companies that are, you know, providing that infrastructure, whether it's burying a line in the ground or offering, you know, kind of better satellite access. It just ends up being really expensive for everyone involved.
Hmm. The FCC said it will be simplifying the application and enrollment process. What does that mean? What's been the problem?
Yeah, so basically, in order to gain access to any of these services, there's a set of forms that have to be filled out, and then it's evaluated whether or not you're eligible based on your financial status and where you live. And if there's an approval that goes out there, you then have to take that approval to the company providing the internet access, and then they have to go and set everything up. It's pretty complicated. You know, the easiest set of processes here that have been documented still limits you to a at least 2 or 3 weeks worth of, you know, kind of jumping through hoops in order to actually get to a point where you're scheduled for internet to be installed in your house.
I'm a bureauphobe, and it overwhelms me to even think about all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, even people who are not that way, nobody likes sitting down and filling out paperwork like that. Like it's you know, it's a really kind of arduous task for something that should be pretty easy to demonstrate that you kind of fit in that category anyway.
They're focusing this on organizations versus individuals, right?
Yeah, so the goal here specifically is to focus on organizations that can help communicate to those communities that this is an option that's available to them. This could be, you know, kind of local financial support groups, or it could be local libraries. You know, it kind of varies depending on the community. But the goal for these grants is to be able to, you know, help encourage the actual community to participate in these things to begin with.
Hmm. And it's eligible. Anybody's eligible, or is it income based?
It's definitely income based, and it depends on the community that you're in and kind of what, you know, providers are available to you. There's really not one, you know, kind of blanket answer. And it's also different for tribal lands as well. Some of the discounts can be more significant in tribal communities.
Okay. Apple in the next year or so is going to be upgrading their earbuds to make it more relevant to health issues. How so?
Yeah, so specifically ear health. This is actually a report that was released by a third party, not by Apple, but it's actually a pretty reasonable set of leaps to make here. Apple has a really cool feature on its Apple Watch right now, where if you're in an area that's too loud, it'll give you a little nudge on your watch that says, "Hey, you are surrounded by sound that is above, let's say, 90 decibels, and that's actually not great for your ear health for extended periods of time." So you may want to remove yourself from that situation, or you know, there's a risk of you know, kind of damage to your ear health. You know, AirPods, a lot of people have found that if they've got them in, they kind of keep them in. That, you know, they kind of wear them all day long because they have a pass-through mode that makes it so that you can talk to other people and you don't have to worry about taking them out when you walk up to a cash register or something like that. The only risk that you run into there is sounding like one of those people who talk to themselves as you're wandering through the you know, not a thing that I've ever been accused of, obviously. but it's not hard to imagine Apple's hardware working together where the watch says, "Hey, it's actually really loud in this area and it's really loud very suddenly. Let me go ahead and turn on the noise isolation feature in those headphones to save this person's ears." to make it so that they are protected.
It would automatically do that?
That is certainly one option. It's something that Apple has done in the past with other things. It's something that's probably opt-in.
Oh, I kind of like this. I mean, I work with a lot of people who wear headphones a lot, and I think they turn them up too loud.
I am also guilty of that. Yeah. So.
And this would help. I mean, hypothetically, I mean, if you already have you can't have your earbuds in when you have headphones on, so it might not work, but.
Yeah, and there are versions of this that exist in other forms of technology already. Samsung's headphones have a feature that connect to your phone, and when your phone goes above a certain volume level when your headphones are connected, it'll give you a warning on your phone that says, hey, you know, if you do this for too long, it's potentially not great for your ears. It's pretty easy to ignore that and turn it up a whole bunch anyway. But there have been, you know, kind of versions of this in the past. What Apple has as kind of its beneficial here is all of the different tools that it already has in both its watch and its phone, and of course the headphones, that set up, you know, this kind of total body, you know, monitoring that allows you to kind of document how many times you've experienced those loud environments over time. And that information can be useful to your doctor, should you decide to share that information over, which is similar to the heart rate data that Apple's been allowing users to share with their doctors, and recently the echocardiograms, or I'm sorry, electrocardiograms that can be recorded through the Apple Watch, where it's not so much about you know, your doctor is not being replaced, but you are being given the tools to give your doctor more information to help a potential diagnosis.
Is that the data that the company will get? Is that what you're talking about?
That is a potential option, is to have that data available for doctors, which is something that Apple has done with other things before, where you can choose to share you know, your medical health information with a doctor who's part of a group that Apple is working with, so that information is still secure, but it's you know, it can help, you know, kind of identify what may be going on.
Well, what form would that, I'm trying to think about, could a physician hypothetically say, I want you to, you know, record your data over the next month and then come back and we'll talk about what we see there and whether or not that's part of the problem or whatever you're in there for.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are hospital groups that have software that allow you to just share immediately.
Okay.
So that information is just a part of your medical profile, should you choose to share it. And that's part of a system that Apple has been building for some time now, is to make it so that information is still secure and kind of shared in a way that is still as private as possible, without that being something that, say, an advertiser can get a hold of.
Apple already has two features. Is it Live Listena?
Listena, yes.
Listena, and Conversation Boost, which make them into an on-demand hearing aid. And the hearing aid, whole world of hearing aids is incredible right now. But what does this do?
Yeah, so I tend to stay pretty far away from anything that claims to be a hearing aid, because that involves a lot of, you know, very specific medical terminology, and like actual doctors get involved at that point, and I am very much not one of those. But the two features that you're referring to here have a lot to do with the way that the microphones in the headphones work at kind of isolating different sounds. And this can be used either to make it easier to hear the world around you through, you know, kind of if you're in a room with a lot of different noise, then someone is speaking directly to you. Those microphones can kind of pick up what is the closest noise and amplify it above everything else so that you're hearing that conversation. And it can also just be used to remove certain sounds from an environment. If you know, are walking down the street and there's a construction, you know, group that you're kind of wandering past, it can try to filter out a bunch of that noise so that you can kind of focus on the other things that are going on around you. Neither one of those tools are what I would call perfect, but they certainly are better for people who have sensitive ears than having nothing.
All of these things do not have approval from the FDA, right? The Food and Drug Administration?
Correct. Yeah, this is something that Apple has been super clear about with the information on its Apple Watch, is that this is not a replacement for a doctor. But it is an additional set of tools that can help a doctor in cases where, you know, it's difficult to, you know, provide a diagnosis.
Okay, so this is interesting. Samsung's pictures of the moon are kind of fake. And when I was reading this, I thought, that's like me wandering around thinking, all these beautiful people with gorgeous blonde hair now. I mean, wow. I went for years not realizing the people were having their hair dyed, and it's so much better now and highlighted and all these things. I mean, I actually thought, it's incredibly naive. I can't believe how many moon pictures I've seen on, you know, social media where I'm like, wow, how do they do that? What's going on?
So in the last couple of years, Apple and Samsung and Google in particular have all launched different initiatives towards what they call astrophotography, which is taking the little camera in your pocket and using it to take really pretty photos at night. In some cases, that is just like a beautiful starscape by way of, kind of allowing for different kinds of photography to take place on your phone, especially in places where there's just not a lot of light and being able to let in more light from different sources in order to get a pretty picture. Samsung's most recent set of phones, the Galaxy S23 series, included this really special moon phase, which was an extension of what it called Super Zoom, which was using its camera. You mount it on a tripod and you point it at something, and it will use a whole bunch of different technologies to come together and take really zoomed in pictures that look really, really clear. And a good example that they used was being able to take pictures of the moon. Here's the thing. Every picture of the moon looks exactly the same because the moon is tidally locked to the Earth. So we only ever see the one side of the moon every time we look up at it. It's the same moon. And Samsung knows this. And so in an effort to make its pictures look nice, is using a form of artificial intelligence to take higher resolution photos of the moon that exist on your phone already and actually put them in place where the moon that you have taken a picture of via Super Zoom would be. It clears up those edges. It makes the moon look really pretty. And the reason that it makes the moon look really pretty is because your phone did not take that picture. It was taken in other places. Now, as you pointed out a moment ago with all of the lovely people with perfectly blonde hair, filters on cameras on your phone, not a new thing. There is a lot of effort that goes into both your front and rear camera making things look much prettier than they may seem to the naked eye. But Samsung made it seem like in its presentation that this was the photos of the moon that you were seeing were something that the camera was capable of, that this was something that your phone was accomplishing while it was in your hand, and not that there was some heavy processing going along to replace that image of the moon.
What I mean, this is not a new, as you said, it's not new, but it was exposed on a Reddit post, right?
Right. This is something where, someone who had a much better idea of the quality of photo that they were taking took a look at the picture that they took and said, this does not line up with what my eyes are seeing. They're like, maybe something else is going on here. And through a series of tests with other cameras that also have very high quality image sensors, including through other Samsung cameras that are of similar quality, discovered that there is a piece of software in there that is basically pasting a higher quality version of the moon over the picture of the moon that your phone took.
What is the tipping point between computer enhanced and fake? I mean, to me, this sounds fake.
See, that's a really good question. And it's also the kind of secondary, the follow-up there is how many people care. When you take a look at your front-facing camera, there's almost always a feature, it has a bunch of different names. I think for a while there, Samsung and LG were referring to it as beauty mode. And there's a couple other different names for it. But it smooths out the wrinkles and it makes your cheeks a little rosier and it highlights you in a couple of different ways. And that's like the default setting in some of these phones when the picture gets taken. That is very clearly not your face, but you tend to not mind because it looks pretty good. So you go and you share it anyway. What you're probably going to find in the not so distant future are people saying the difference being, hey, I took this photo on my phone versus, hey, I took a raw version of this image and I have edited it myself. Because the language there is very specific, and in a lot of cases, your phone is capable of taking what are called raw photos that can then be edited later by a professional.
So how is Samsung responding to the shade on this?
Barely at all. This is something where Samsung bragged about this feature on stage when the phone was being sold. This is it is in a way, technically, doing exactly what Samsung said it was going to be doing. The difference here is that Samsung did not say that it was using artificial intelligence to enhance the photo of the moon that you had taken. It was just saying that, you know, the camera can do this thing. And you know, if you go by the definition of the way that most smartphone cameras works, that is true. But it is a little on the disingenuous side. And it means that if you own a more recent Samsung phone and you took a really sweet picture of the moon, you had a lot of help along the way.
We have like 20 seconds. I want thumbs up, thumbs down on The Last of Us.
Oh, absolutely thumbs up. I made a lot of people really mad by saying we should just end it that one season because it was genuinely a perfect season of this show.
Yeah,
and we should just not, we shouldn't mess with it because it was very, very good. But we've already gotten greenlit for a second season, so I'm not going to get my wish.
It is to be messed with. That is Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you, Russell. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.